We're in the middle now of a series on Judges. And Judges is kind of this interesting book in the Old Testament. And as we noted last week, it's got this really interesting space in sort of the history of the development of Israel. There are four characters in Judges that get mentioned in the book of Hebrews. So 4-week series, those are the four people we want to talk about. And again, it's worth reminding ourselves that what's going on in the book of Judges is it's this story of these warrior heroes, right? The judges aren't what you think of as guys in the black robes sitting on the Supreme Court, right? These are all warrior heroes that lead battles, and they do great things. And it's really the Old Testament's book of mythology, right? These are these stories of these giant, larger-than-life figures that we look to and we read the stories and we say, wow, there's something here to emulate, there's something here to praise. And again, we'll pause to note, right, saying that it's a book of mythology doesn't mean it's not true, right? A lot of the myths are true and they have their roots. And so the story and the analogy to mythology is that these are these larger-than-life figures. They come in, they walk onto the scene, they do something amazing. The other thing we noted last week is the book of Judges is incredibly repetitive, right? Every single story in the book of Judges, the long ones and the short ones, have exactly the same pattern. The Israelites are off worshiping another god. God sends in these raiders or this invading army that comes and oppresses the Israelites. The Israelites get tired of oppression, turn to God, say, save us. God causes to rise up this warrior hero that comes in, fights off the evil forces that invaded the land of Israel, and then the Israelites return to God while the judge is there. The judge dies, Israelites go back to worshiping other gods, and we repeat the pattern over and over and over and over. So if you're expecting the sort of the basic plot is different this week than last week, I told you last week, it's the same sermon for 4 weeks in a row. And so what we have this week is we get the slight variant on the story because the invading armies are different and the warrior hero is slightly different. And last week we were looking at the story of Barak, and Barak was coming in, and he's the warrior hero that gets mentioned in Hebrews because he's the one leading the army. But as we noted, Barak doesn't actually do anything. There's these two other people that they don't really do much either. And so we have a story there kind of pointing out this. God's the one doing all this stuff. Today we get the story of Gideon. And Gideon is a much better story than the story of Barak, right? If you want the epitome in Judges of the warrior hero, it's Gideon. He's the one you would pick out. In fact, he's so obviously the one. The writer of Hebrews has this interesting thing that goes on. He's running through the history of Israel, talking about there's this hero, this his hero. Then he gets to Judges, and that's when he says, but I don't have time to talk about them all. But here's a rundown of other names. And the first name he lists is Gideon, then Barak, right? So Barak, who comes before Gideon, gets listed after Gideon in Hebrews. And it's almost like you can imagine the writer of Hebrews saying, okay, who's the other famous people? Oh, Gideon, he's the famous one. And then he thinks, oh, wait a minute. There was that other guy before. Who was it? And he had to go back and say, oh, yeah, Barak. And then he gets the rest of them in chronological order. So Gideon is sort of this great guy that we all know. Gideon is also the perfect Sunday school story, right? There's no tent pegs in this story, right? I mean, it is a great kind of character because you imagine rolling in to talk to kids in Sunday school class and you get to tell the story of Gideon. The story of Gideon is great, right? The Midianites are the evil invading force. And the Midianites turn out to be, you don't have to mention this in Sunday school, but you can, right? They're not like an invading army. They're like raiders, right? They sort of roll in, they devastate everything, and then they roll back out. And so they're constantly rolling in and laying waste and stealing everything and then going back out. And they got camels. So last week, you know, there was Sisera in his chariots, and the chariots keep getting mentioned. And the story of Gideon, you keep hearing about the camels, right? The camels are really scary, obviously, to the Israelites, which seems a little weird. We don't think of camels as scary animals. But if you imagine the war between the people riding camels and the Israelites who would have been riding donkeys, it's easy to see why they might be scared of the camels, right? I'd rather have to be on the camel too, right? So the Midianites are in here raiding and raiding and raiding, and then God raises up Gideon, and Gideon gets his army to go fight off the Midianites, but then there's this great story about the army. Gideon calls together an army and gets 32,000 people. Now, if you remember last week, Barak had 10,000 people, right? So Gideon's army is over three times larger than Barak's army, and this is great. Now we're going to have this epic battle, but then God comes along and says, too big of an army, right? If you beat back the Midianites with 32,000 people, everybody's going to say, hey, the great army did it, and God wants all the credit here. So he says, this is what I want you to do. Go talk to all these 32,000 people and say, if you're scared, go home. That's all he has to say. If you're scared, go home. And out of the 32,000 people who've just shown up for the army, 22,000 of them go home. Now we're down to a 10,000 person army. That sounds better. That's like Barack's army. But we already know that the Barack army, we already missed the point of the Barack army. We're looking around for a hero. So God says, you know what? Too big of an army still. So this is what we need to do. We need to shrink it down even further. And then you get this great story. He says, take the 10,000 people down to the river and tell them to take a drink. That's the command. So everybody goes down to the river, and the guy says this. He says, okay, this is what I want you to do. People are taking a drink in two different ways. Some people are down on their knees drinking out of the river. Other people are lapping like a dog, right? They're sort of picking up the water and lapping it out of their hands like a dog. And you hear that difference, right? Do you want the army of the people that lap like a dog or the people that drink normally? And God wants the people of army of people that lap like a dog. And out of the 10,000 people, how many of them drink in this really weird way? 300. That's the army, right? And so the other 9,700 people, all of whom are brave, scrapping warriors who just happen to drink out of rivers normally, right? They all get sent home. And we spend a lot of time trying to figure out, well, why is the lapping like a dog thing better than the getting on your knees and drinking thing, right? And there's all sorts of great stories about it. Lapping like a dog, by the way, is a weird way to phrase it because dogs are a dirty, disgusting animal in Hebrew literature, right? And so it's like, it's not the obvious comparison you want, right? And so people tell the stories about, well, if you're standing up drinking out like this, then you're being more alert than if you're on your knees or something. I mean, maybe that's what's going on. But the real point of the story is, Gideon now has an army of 300 people, and that's it. And he's got to go fight the Midianites, who have camels. And now he got this big problem. So how do you do this battle? And then you get the great battle. What he does is brilliant, right? And he goes along and he tells everybody, he says, okay, this is what I want you to do. Everybody get a big horn, a ram's horn, and everybody put a pitcher inside a jug. Now, these are not normal instruments of war, right? So they all show up with their horns and their pitchers with torches in them. And they go at night and they circle. Not really, they stand in three different places, but you can imagine them circling the Midianites. And then on command, they all blow the horns and break the jugs. And so the Midianite army suddenly sees 300 torches popping into view, 300 horns blowing, and what do they all think? We are surrounded by a massive army. Because let's be honest, if you see 300 torches, how many people are out there? You don't think there's 300 people out there standing torches. You think they're probably guys with swords and stuff too or something, right? So these 300 guys, mass confusion in the Midianite army, they all get routed, then the Israelites roll in all the confusion, and Gideon wins the day. This is a fantastic Sunday school story, right? Because you could tell this story, and Gideon comes along and says, he's a really tricky guy, right? And that's sort of the mythology of Gideon. It's Gideon the trickster, right? I mean, this was brilliant, right? You're going to go fight an army, and you come up with this really tricky, clever way to win this battle. They are all confused, and you can win with only 300 people against a great army. This idea of the trickster hero is a staple in sort of all the mythological accounts. The Greeks have Odysseus, the wily Odysseus, who comes up with that Trojan horse scheme, right? And that's kind of tricky, too. It's kind of clever. But the epitome of the tricky hero is Loki, the Norse god, right? Loki is like the trickster god in Norse mythology. He runs around and he's constantly playing tricks on everybody. He's constantly disguising himself and sowing confusion and running around doing all these things. And Loki's kind of a weird god in Norse mythology because Loki's brother Thor is like the epitome of a Norse god. Thor, you can imagine, god of thunder, not lightning, thunder. He's loud, he's brash. You imagine big burly Viking guy. He's got his war hammer and he can go destroy everything. All the Norse heroes and gods are like that. They are all big Viking warrior types. Even the women are big Viking warrior types in Norse mythology. And then you have Loki. And Loki comes across straight through the story as this scared little god who's constantly frightened and constantly trying to weasel his way out of bad situations and constantly playing to trick tricks on people. And you put Loki next to Thor and you imagine brave, strong Thor and sniveling, scared little Loki. And Loki is constantly causing problems in Norse mythology. He's not a villain, right? When Marvel rips off the universe, he turns into a villain. He's not really a villain. He's constantly hanging out with his brother and his father, Odin, right? But he's constantly the scared guy just playing tricks on people. And you think, okay, so we have Gideon, our hero. You have Loki, the trickster god. They're not that much alike, right? And therein lies a tale. Because Because it turns out this story of Gideon that we see is only a small slice of the whole story of Gideon that shows up in the book of Judges. And that whole story of Gideon has a really interesting portrait thing going on. So now, just like last week, it's story time. The story starts this way, right? The Midianites have come. They're oppressing the Israelites. The Israelites are upset. Same start of the story every time. And so they're there, and every other Israelites are scared. God sends a prophet, says, okay, you know, I hear you appealing to me, I'll liberate you. And then we get the story beginning, Judges chapter 6, verse 11. The angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak in Ophrah that belonged to Joash the Abrazite, where his son Gideon, here's our hero, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in a wine press to keep it from the Midianites. We meet Gideon, and what is he doing? He's hiding in a wine press to thresh the wheat because he's so scared of all the Midianites coming and finding out he has some wheat. That's how we meet this guy. He's hiding, he's afraid, he's trying to do something here that nobody really knows what he's doing. When the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." And that's, I mean, how is that not a joke, right? I mean, mighty warrior, and what is this guy? He's the guy hiding in a wine press threshing grain, and the angel of the Lord says, "Here I am, mighty warrior." And now we know Gideon's going to rise up as the mighty warrior. And what does Gideon say? "But sir," Gideon replied, "if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all his wonders that our fathers told us about when they said, 'Did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt?' But now the Lord has abandoned us and put us into the hands of Midian." Mighty warrior starts whining. Like, what do you mean? I mean, where are you? I mean, what's going on here? I don't understand. And then God says, the Lord turned to him and said, "Go in strength that you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you? And so, mighty warrior, go in strength." And then Gideon says, "But Lord," Gideon asked, "how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I'm the least in my family." This is not mighty warrior breaking, right? This is the guy who instantly hears God rolling and say, "You are a mighty warrior," and says, "Me? No, I'm from the weak little family, and I'm like the nothing in the family," right? Now, we know he actually has servants and slaves and everything. He's not like from some pathetic little family. He's just doing the whole, like, you got to be kidding, right? Go get Thor, right? I mean, you're sort of imagining what's going on in his mind here, and he's scared, and he's terrified, and he's like, what's going on? So he says, right? The Lord answered, "I will be with you, and you will strike down all the Midianites together." And Gideon replied, "If now I've found favor in your eyes, give me a sign that it's really you talking to me. Please do not go away until I come back and bring my offering and set it before you." And so Gideon says, "Oh, look, I'm going to test you. I just need a sign. If you give me a sign, then I'll believe." So he goes off, and it takes a whole paragraph to prepare a big kind of thing to give out for her. And he brings out this feast, sets it on a rock, and the Lord torches the offering, just sort of points staff at it, boom, bursts into flames, right? Now, if you want a sign, that's not a bad one, right? And then what does Gideon say? Gideon, verse 22. When Gideon realized that it was the angel of the Lord, he exclaimed, "Ah, oh, sovereign Lord, I've seen an angel of the Lord face to face." And you read it with the exclamation points there, and you think, oh, well, finally he's rising up. But then note the next thing. "But the Lord said to him, 'Peace, do not be afraid, you are not going to die.'" This is one terrified hero in this story. We meet Gideon, and it's got these echoes of Moses, right? God comes to him and says, "Go do this thing." And Moses spends an entire chapter in Exodus saying, "I think you got the wrong guy." And then at the end of that chapter, he spends another chapter saying, "Really, I really think you have the wrong guy." Gideon, unfortunately, has spent two full chapters saying, "I think you got the wrong guy." But he's clearly sitting here constantly saying, "I'm not up for this. I'm terrified. I want a sign." And you can see why he asked for a sign, because then when there's no sign, then he knows. But then when you get the sign, then what happens? Now he's really scared, right? So then Gideon gets his first command, and it's this. He says, "You know, there's that altar to Baal over there. I want you to tear it down, and I want you to put an altar up to me instead." So there's Gideon's first command, and Gideon does it. But it's kind of weird. Verse 27. "So Gideon took 10 of his servants and did as the Lord told him." That's good. But because he was afraid of his family and the men of the town, he did it at night rather than the daytime. So here we have him doing it, but he's still terrified. And you can just see, you know, it's right there. He can go tear the thing down. He can put up, he's had the sign from God. God's been talking to him. You can imagine just boldly walk up there and do this thing, right? I mean, when God's just told you, be strong, you're a mighty warrior, go do this thing. And then he says, okay, I'll do it. But I'm going to wait till night, right? When nobody will know it's me, right? And I'll sneak up there at night and I'll do it. And everybody will wake up the next morning and be all surprised. And you can just imagine they're all going to think, oh, who did this? And nobody will really know it's me. But unfortunately, somebody tipped it off. Everyone in town figures out it was Gideon who did it. So the mob forms. Turns out he's right to be afraid of what everybody would think. The mob forms, marches to the house, says, you know what? Gideon tore down the temple to Baal there. We've got to kill him. And then we get this great line, right? Verse 31. Are you going to plead Baal's cause? Are you trying to save him? Whoever fights for him will be put to death by morning. If Baal really is a god, he can defend himself when somebody breaks down his altar. And that is great. That is bold, right? You're looking at the mob that's come to kill Gideon, and you look at it and you say, why do you need to defend Baal? If Baal's really can defend himself, can't he? And you can imagine the mob all looking around saying, oh, well, you know, maybe that's right. And this great bold speech was not made by Gideon at all. It was Gideon's dad who said that, right? So now you imagine Gideon hiding in the back of the tent while his dad marches out and boldly says, Baal can defend himself. And nice Gideon here has just been sort of cowering in the background. Doesn't show up at all in the scene at all, right? He gets even renamed as sort of the guy who let Baal contend with him, Jerubbaal, right? He gets a new name out of this. But you look at what he did. We have a hero now who at every turn has been scared and scared and scared and scared. And then Midianites come back and God says to him, go do it. And you'd think by now Gideon gets the point, but he doesn't. Gideon said to God, verse 36, if you will save Israel by my hand as you've promised, I got another test for you. One test wasn't enough. I got another one for you. Look, I will place a wool fleece on the threshing floor. If there's dew only on the fleece and the ground is dry, then I will know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you said. So he makes another test, and he wakes up the next morning, and lo and behold, ground is dry, fleece is wet. Passed the test. He's now had two signs. And then you can see Gideon thinking, wait a minute, that was a stupid test, right? Because what happens if you put a fleece out in the morning? Which dries first, ground or fleece? Ground always dries first. And so he says, ah, that's really dumb. So then you can hear, you can just hear the voice. Then Gideon said to God, do not be angry with me. Let me just make one more request. Let's flip it this time. Ground wet, fleece dry, right? And you can kind of, I mean, think of it. This is the third time he's gone and said, if you really want me to do this, I just need a sign, right? That's all I need, right? And the third time, asks for a sign, and lo and behold, wakes up next morning, ground wet, fleece dry. This one's a little hard to explain, right? And so now we get the great story we tell in Sunday school. God goes out, gives him the army, gets down to 300, and we now have Gideon and the 300 brave souls, except they're not all brave, it turns out. There's been a mistake in the selection process. There's one of these people who's terrified. Guess who? Chapter 7, verse 9. During the night, the Lord said to Gideon, get up, go down against the camp, because I'm going to give it into your hands. If you are afraid to attack, go down to camp with your servant Purah and listen to what they are saying. Afterwards, you will be encouraged to attack the camp. So now you imagine Gideon, right? 32,000 people gathered. The command, if you're scared, go home. And Gideon's thinking what? Wait a minute, I'm scared, right? But he sticks it out. And then he says, oh, he's like 10,000. And now he's down to 300 people. And the Midianites have all those camels. The 300 people are all brave, but our hero is still terrified of everything. So God tells him, if you're scared, go down to camp. And you'd think this is the perfect test for Gideon. Say, oh, I'm not scared. I've got three signs. I know this is going to work out. But now he goes down to camp. Here's this dream. The dream is great, right? Because it's this weird dream about a roll of a loaf of bread rolling down and knocking down a tent. And then some guy says, oh, I know what that dream means. It means Gideon's going to kill us all. So Gideon, I mean, you want to talk about an interpretation of a dream. It's right there for Gideon. Like, oh, they just said I'm going to feed. So then he goes up and he fights the battle. And what we have at this point is a strange warrior hero who at every point in this story has been scared. He's been afraid. He's been fearful. He wins this battle by trickery, right? And then they finally wins the battle. He does win the battle, right? Routs the Midianites, and he starts pursuing them, and a nice army gathers around him as he pursues them. But this narrative of fear keeps going in the story. In chapter 8, the Israelites are pursuing the Midianite kings. And we get down to verse 4-ish. Gideon and his 300 men, exhausted yet keeping up the pursuit, came to the Jordan and crossed it. He said to the men of Succoth, "Give my troops some bread. They are worn out, and I am still pursuing Zebah and Zalmunna, kings of Midian." But the officials of Succoth said, "Do you already have the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna in your possession? Why should we give bread to your troops?" So then we have a whole town here that's terrified to give bread to 300 warriors, because what if they lose? Then what are the Midianites going to do? They're going to say, "Hey, you help out those guys." So they refuse to do it. Then Gideon replied, "Just for that, when the Lord has given Zebah and Zalmunna into my hand, I will tear your flesh with desert thorns and briars." From there he went up to Peniel and made the same request of them, but they answered the same as the men of Succoth had. So when the men, he said to the men of Peniel, "When I return in triumph, I will tear down this tower." So we have two whole towns that are terrified. In both cases, Gideon says, "You know what? I'm going to get you guys when we're all done with this." He goes off, captures the kings, on his way back does exactly what he said to both of the towns. But then we get another great story. You've now got these kings of the Midianites. Verse 20 for chapter 8. Turning to Jether, his oldest son, he said, "Kill them." But Jether, Gideon's son, did not draw his sword because he was only a boy and was afraid. I mean, we have again somebody being afraid. So Gideon has to go kill them himself. So he does that. Then we get a curious story. Chapter 8, verse 22. The Israelites said to Gideon, "Rule over us, you, your son, and your grandson, because you've saved us out of the hand of Midian." But Gideon told them, "I will not rule over you, nor will my son rule over you. The Lord will rule over you." And that's one of those great verses. We stop there. Man, that's an amazing verse, right? That is a great reply, right? It's like the reply you'd want. And he said, sadly goes on, "I do have one request, that each of you give me an earring from your share of the plunder." It was the custom of the Ishmaelites to wear gold earrings. They answered, "We'll be glad to give them to you." So they spread out a garment, and each man threw a ring from his plunder onto it. The weight of the gold rings he asked for came to 1,700 shekels, not counting the ornaments and the pendants, the purple garments worn by the kings of Midian, or the chains that were on their camels' necks. Gideon made the gold into an ephod, which he placed in Ophrah, this town. All Israel prostituted themselves by worshiping it there, and it became a snare to Gideon and his family. This is a weird story, right? He says, "Oh no, it's all about Lord, right? But this is what I want. I just want an earring." And he gets all these earrings, and he makes this gold ephod. Now, everybody's trying to figure out what the heck this is, right? We know from sort of the Deuteronomy law, the ephod was like a garment the priests wore, right? But he's making one out of gold, right? And he's setting it up, and so it seems, and maybe it's still a garment, he's just sort of putting it on like a mannequin out there in town square or something. I mean, we have no idea sort of what's really going on here, right? But he makes this thing, and then we find out everybody starts looking at this ephod. They prostitute themselves before it. Same kind of language we constantly hear about the Israelites going off and worshiping other gods. And then it becomes a snare for Gideon and his family. Somehow or another, this ephod is turned into this idol. We have echoes of the golden calf story here. Suddenly, they come to him and said, "You know what? We want you to be a king." And what is Gideon saying? "Oh, no, not me, not me, not me. It's going to be Lord." But then he makes this thing here that everybody starts worshiping and becomes a snare for Gideon. Gideon then proceeds in the story, has 70 sons, right? Very prolific, right? 70 sons plus one. 70 legitimate kids, one illegitimate kid, right? 70 sons, and then he dies. The Israelites, of course, immediately then turn to other gods right afterwards. And then we get a really fascinating kind of bizarre story in Judges 10. There's a lot of bizarre stories here. I keep saying that. So we get this bizarre story in chapter 9 of the son that wasn't legitimate, Abimelech, right? Abimelech then goes to the town and says, "Hey, do you really want 70 rulers or just one? Help me out. We'll kill all 70 of Gideon's sons. I'll be the ruler then." and they go out and they get 69 of the 70 sons. Of course, they don't get one of them, right? The one comes out, makes an impassioned speech to everybody saying, "You fools!" And then, of course, what happens after he makes his "you fool" speech? Chapter 9, verse 21, then Jotham, Gideon's son, fled, escaping to Beer, and he lived there because he was afraid of his brother Abimelech, right? So he runs away afraid too. The Abimelech story ends in kind of a funny way. In the end of chapter 9, Abimelech is out launching a war. You know, he's constantly having to fight through the whole chapter. And in verse 52, Abimelech went to the tower and stormed it. But as he approached the entrance to the tower to set it on fire, a woman dropped an upper millstone on his head and cracked his skull. Hurriedly, he called his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and kill me so that they can't say a woman killed him." So his servant ran him through and he died. And what's really funny about that is in the book of Samuel, it turns out Abimelech being killed by a woman with a millstone at the wall is like a Israeli proverb of sort of bad fighting kind of thing. So it didn't work, you know, so everybody knows. And what's interesting about the woman killing him is this is a complete echo of the Barak story, right, where Sisera was killed at the hand of a woman. So we have this really weird set of stories in Gideon that if you look not just at the big story we tell in Sunday school, but the narrative as a whole, and you ask, what's the unifying theme throughout this whole thing? It's fear. This is a story of a bunch of scared people. I mean, these people are all terrified. God's there. He's saying, go do this thing. And Gideon's afraid throughout. The towns are afraid. Gideon's sons are afraid. Everybody is constantly afraid. And is the moral here, don't be afraid? Is fear somehow this big sin here? And it's hard to sell that story because we have this really weird story in the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke of Jesus going off to Gethsemane. He's about to die and he's scared and he's praying to God, "Lord, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me." And in Luke it says, God sends an angel to strengthen Jesus. Jesus is scared too. Being scared, it turns out, is normal when you're faced with this world. People are constantly afraid of things. We're afraid of doing wrong things. We're afraid when we're raising our kids that we're not going to do a job. We're afraid of our coworkers. We're afraid of what people think. We live our lives sort of running through, sort of, am I doing things right here? And I'm a little bit afraid of this, and I'm a little bit afraid of that. And this story of Gideon is really a story, when you're looking at it, of how do people respond to these fears? And what we see is these three really bad ways of responding to fears, one after another. The first one is this. Gideon's afraid, and so what does he do? He starts asking for signs. And this story is just mocks the asking for signs thing, because let's be honest, we've all done that at some point in our lives. Faced with this thing and we're a little bit afraid, what decision should I make? So we pray, God, just give me a sign, right? And then God gives a sign, but we never quite know how to interpret the sign, right? So asking for a sign in general doesn't work very well, right? In the Iron Fist, the series on Marvel just put out, right? There's this great moment where the Iron Fist is sitting there and he sees a hawk flying. Now, does the hawk flying, is that a sign that he should leave the place he is and go fight others, or is it the sign that he should stay where he is? And there's a big debate in one of the episodes about what did the sign mean, and that's what it is. If we just ask for a sign and something happens, how do we interpret it? So we don't want to do that. We want to ask for a sign. We say, if you want me to do X, then make this happen. Now that's where it gets tricky asking for signs, right? Because if you say, if you want me to boldly stand up and talk about Christ, then make the sun rise in the east tomorrow. That's not a good sign, because you sort of know what's going to happen. I didn't really want that answer necessarily. But we also know you can't say, if you want me to do this, make the sun rise in the west tomorrow, because we know that's not going to happen. And that's sort of. So what we need is a sign of something that could happen, but maybe not happen. Maybe if it's sunny tomorrow, then that's a sign. But if it's only sunny between 10 and 11:30, was that the sun sign or the cloud sign? We can do it with coin flips, and you've all done this, right? You flip a coin, it comes up heads. And now, I didn't really flip it well. So you flip it again, and you flip it really well this time, and it comes up tails. But now is it like the first one has the best 2 out of 3, right? We're constantly testing God's for these signs. And we all know from personal experience, if we're honest with ourselves, the sign thing doesn't work very cleanly or very clearly. And that's exactly what's going on with Gideon. You can see the first time, give me a sign you want me to do this. It's torch. Oh man, I didn't really want that answer, right? The second time, the fleece thing, and he's thinking, oh good, I didn't want that answer. Oh, but you know, obviously. So the third sign, and he just keeps doing it over and over and over again. Second big thing people do in their fear, that's the ephod story. What's going on with that? We have a whole set of people who've been scared of the Midianites, and they want Gideon to come be their hero. And he says, oh, I'm not going to do it. So what do they end up doing? They go find this object, this religious thing. And it's really important that it's a religious thing. It's not like some non-religious. It's the same as the golden calf story. In the golden calf story, Aaron goes to people and says, this is your God. It's meant to be, the golden calf is meant to be God. It's not supposed to be one of the, it's God. And the ephod is clearly supposed to be like, the Lord will rule over you. And here's the Lord right here. He's this ephod thing. And everybody goes and finds this object. And we fascinate by the object. And we take the object and we treat it like, okay, yeah, that will give me comfort in my time of stress. And then the last thing we do is we look for the leader, the person. And that's really the interesting thing about the Abimelech story. Because here are the Israelites who are scared. They've gone to Gideon and say, be our leader. And he says, no. And so now Abimelech comes along and says, I'll be your leader. And then Jotham's warning to the Israelites. Chapter 9, verse 7. When Jotham was told about this, he climbed up on top of Mount Gerizim and shouted at them, listen to me, citizens of Shechem, so that God may listen to you. One day, the trees went out to anoint a king for themselves. They said to the olive tree, be our king. But the olive tree answered, should I give up my oil, which both gods and men are honored, and holds sway over the trees? Next the tree said to the fig tree, come and be our king. But the fig tree replied, should I give up my fruit, so good and sweet, to hold sway over the trees? Then the tree said to the vine, come, be our king. But the vine answered, should I give up my wine, which cheers both gods and men, to hold sway over the trees? Finally, all the trees said to the thorn bush, come be our king. The thorn bush said to the trees, if you really want to anoint me the king over you, come and take refuge in my shade. But if not, then let fire come out of the thorn bush and consume the cedars of Lebanon. Here are the trees looking for a leader, and they go to the olive. That's a good tree. Has no interest. Go to the fig. No interest. Go to the grape. No interest. The thorn bush, though, is happy to be the leader of the trees. Come take refuge under my shade, says the thorn bush. And I don't know if you've ever taken refuge under a thorn bush to shade you from the elements. The sun is a little bit nicer than that thorn bush is. And here's Jotham saying, you guys wanted a leader so bad, you just got a thorn bush as your leader. In every case, we find these people who are afraid, searching after something to take care of their fear. Where should all these people be looking when they're afraid? And you know the punchline. The writer of Hebrews makes it painfully clear in the section where he's talking about all the people. Hebrews. We'll pick up in chapter 10. Verse 32. Remember those earlier days after you'd received the light, when you stood your ground in a great contest in the face of suffering. Sometimes you were publicly exposed to insult and persecution. At other times you stood side by side with those who were so treated. You sympathized with those in prison and joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property because you knew that you yourselves had better and lasting possessions. So do not throw away your confidence. It will be richly rewarded. You need to persevere so that when you've done the will of God, you will receive what he has promised. For in just a little while, he who is coming will come and not delay. But my righteous one will live by faith, and if he shrinks back, I will not be pleased with him. But we are not of those who shrink back and are destroyed, but of those who believe and are saved. Now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we see. Writer of Hebrews is looking out and saying, you're afraid, and I know you're afraid. And what do you do when you're afraid? You have faith that Christ is there. We need faith in Christ because we are afraid. If we weren't afraid, it's easy to roll through life. But it's because life is challenging and scary. That's why we need faith. And what happens to us all the time when we get afraid is we are constantly looking for other ways to take care of our fear. We're looking to each other. We're looking for leaders. We're looking for things. We're looking for signs. We're looking for all sorts of ways to deal with our fear. And we often do not stop and say, you know what I need to be thinking about? I just need to be focused on Christ. And that's the solution to the fear. Hebrews chapter 12, Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him has endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. We read that last week. I told you it's the same sermon every week, right? This is exactly the point of the story of Gideon. We have a scared guy filled in a scared nation, and Gideon makes it into Hebrews as an example of faith. Why? Because he's so afraid. And even though he's so terrified, God says, take these 300 people against that army with camels, and he's terrified, and he does it anyway. And he doesn't find comfort anywhere other than just saying, you know what? I'm going to go do this thing. That's the lesson for us when you're scared. When you're scared, remember, Christ was scared too. And Christ went to the cross. And that's why we don't have to be scared.